The Last Word with Matt Cooper.
It turns out that our week trending contributors, Sarah McGuinness, assistant news editor of the Business Post, and John Gibbons, our Last Word environment commentator, have both been following the British election coverage avidly. So that gives us an excuse to play briefly from the BBC's coverage last night, the new Health Secretary, Labour's Wes Streeting, making a point, sort of, about how Keir Starmer has reformed the Labour Party.
And yes, the implosion of the Conservatives and the SNP has put wind in Labour's sails. But the only reason we've got sails on the ship, and the ship is shipshape, is because Keir Starmer took the vessel from the shipwreck in 2019, rebuilt it, and made it ship, you know, shipshape and seaworthy again.
Oh, dear Lord.
And did he have the Titanic in sight? Maybe or the iceberg for the Titanic?
Literal babbling, like, just stop talking.
It was entertaining television, a lot of it last night. I think, Sarah, like myself, you were watching Channel 4, and particularly the barbs between Alistair Campbell and Nadine Dorries.
You actually couldn't write it. Like, her infatuation with Boris Johnson was just, it was really comedic, but also, like, what is going on here? But then, no offence to anyone who worked on the BBC election special, that was a bit of a snooze fest. So I was kind of like, I'm just going to have to stick with this. It was wild viewing for what actually was quite, I wouldn't say exciting election, but there was definitely, you know, There were plenty of talking points. It was quite lively. They had a wide, pretty broad ranging panel. So yeah, no, it was... I'm tired today, but that's okay.
It was quite funny because last night Channel 4 went from about 8:45 or so all the way through to 9 o'clock this morning with the same team on air. And I gave it up after midnight, went to bed, got back up about 7:30. And I noticed that Emily Maitlis by that stage had more or less lost it with Nadine Dorries. Whatever about Alistair Campbell, she was like, literally, you could see, what is this woman doing here? Why is she still here?
No, God
and was
bless.
Just going for her.
Well, I mean, as well, particularly if you're someone who's worked in Channel 4, and you know Nadine Dorries' stance on Channel 4, like, you would kind of be like, why are we facilitating this woman and her kind of like absurd views
for ratings, John?
Oh, I think so. It was quite the show, and I think also the impression Emily Maitlis gave that she wasn't a big fan of Jeremy Corbyn. Her body language during the Jeremy Corbyn interview was incredible.
I didn't see that.
Yeah, she actually looked off camera for the entire duration of the interview. It was really, but maybe it was also just a very long night and people were getting tired and emotional.
And to be fair to Emily Maitlis, then she was doing her news agent's recording at 5 a.m. and then she had to go on television again, and then she was back on at lunchtime with another news agent's podcast. That poor woman's probably wrecked. I wouldn't be having much from Jeremy Corbyn either.
Okay, did you watch it all through the night, John?
No, I didn't. I watched it for a couple of hours, and once I knew the way it was going, I've been underwhelmed by the whole process.
Four Green MPs elected, though.
That's right. I mean, it's
and it's harder for them over there in the first past the post. I mean, there were some sort of unusual results in that. Four Greens, four of the Reform Party or business that Nigel Farage has, although on a much bigger vote, and then I think five or six independents as well. But the Greens, and they won in Bristol, but they also won in rural areas.
That's right. I mean, those four Greens, that represented about 7%, I think, of the first preference, which, if you translated that into the Parliament of 650 seats, if they were getting it across the board, they should probably have had about nearly 50 seats based on a 7%.
If you're talking about a proportional representation system.
Like, if that was the Irish PR system, that's what you're getting. But obviously,
I bet you there'd be people now texting in saying, thank God that they don't have the Irish PR system and it saves them from having too many Greens inside in their parliament.
Well, I think what the PR system saves us from is the kind of situation where a party gets 34% of the vote and 60-something percent of the seats. That is just crazy. I think the two-party system in Britain is breaking because, of course, it's no longer a two-party state. And you can see that.
But the voting system is set up for that.
It was set up for that, Matt, but it's not going to survive it. I mean, I think it's so outrageous, the disconnect between Labour's share and their seats, that I think there will be pressure. But obviously, the big parties, they like the system pretty well, because it
means one or the other will be the party in power. But yep. I suppose they also argue, Sarah, that it gives them stable government, that they don't actually have to form coalitions, and this Labour Party now will have 5 years to get on with things, and people can make their judgment in 5 years' time.
Yeah, this is true in a sense, but I think that like one thing that was really emerging were kind of all the fractions between not like just like say people on the right end of the spectrum or people in the centre. It was left, right and centre. Like the votes, nobody could have guessed, I suppose, how fractious it actually would have been, and key areas that Labour should have won, they didn't, and then they had landslide victories in others. Like, I think it was a really interesting election in that sense. Like, I'm not going to pretend to know a whole lot about the British electoral system, but I suppose this is the first one where I've actually been paying a hell of a lot of attention, and it seems like the most kind of interesting one in a couple of decades.
Okay, probably since the 99 landslide that Labour had on a much bigger vote at the time. But then, you know, people get a bit cynical about politics. And I wonder if something that happened in the Dáil this week, John Gibbons, gives rise to that. Because we've been hearing about the passing of the pensions bill. It's been described as historic in relation to auto-enrolment pension legislation. And when it went through the Dáil, how many TDs were present?
I believe there was one TD, as far as I know. It was Michael Healy-Ray was the only TD present.
As well as Government Minister Heather Humphreys.
Obviously the Minister presenting. But that was it, yeah. And I think the other TDs were around the place, but obviously I presume they were at the back and probably awaiting.
Apparently Healy-Ray didn't stay for the whole thing either.
Right. And I suppose it's not a good look. I think that's the point. And the Ceann Comhairle sort of brought attention to it by making the statement that how disappointing it was. And it is important legislation. They're saying that basically this is sort of 30 years in the making, and this idea of having said that, let's be honest, you know, as soon as you mention the word pensions, everybody begins to drift off, and when you prefix it by automatic enrolment, you can see the heads nodding and the eyes rolling.
Sarah, this is very important to people.
I think this is an absolute disaster, particularly when all TDs had to be present in the Dáil 10 minutes later to do their, what were they in for, their weekly votes. Yep. They were all in the building anyway. Like, you'd think some, particularly Fine Gael and Fianna Fáil, like trying to come across as like, you know, trying to really, like Jack Chambers, for example, why wasn't he there? This is a money thing. He is the newly established Minister for Finance. Why was he not there? I think it's absolutely ludicrous. And considering that this has been, Fine Gael have been accused of kicking this down the road for so long, you think that they would kind of claim this victory? I just don't get it.
Okay, let's move on to other things. And before I go to John on this, Eimear Higgins, the junior business minister, earlier this week, she wouldn't come on the programme to tell us why it was she was trying to put pressure on Dublin City Council to delay the implementation of new traffic management plans for Dublin City Centre from August. But it appears that has her pressure behind the scenes maybe had a bit of an impact, because it does seem that the City Council is diluting the plans a little bit.
Diluting and delaying, it seems. Yeah, so as you mentioned, Eimear Higgins, Fine Gael Minister of State, has seemingly intervened on what is a Dublin City Council. So not in the remit of government, of, you know, core government, local authority government, and met with businesses and basically kind of heard their concerns about it, and then seemingly kind of proposed that the plan be delayed. There's already been a lot of kickback from the business community. And I suppose in her role as Minister of State in the Department of Enterprise, she kind of has to hear that because she's there to represent them. But really, it was kind of quite inappropriate that she would like put her own like weight behind.
They could have just ignored her.
Yeah, completely. They could have. And to be fair, this isn't a great look for Richard Shakespeare, who isn't in the job of Dublin City Council Chief Executive for that long. You know, this policy, John can definitely speak to this more than I can, but like it's been a big body of work for Dublin City Council. It's really going to change the face of the city, whether people wanted to or not. And I suppose to kind of be bending to a junior minister as opposed to kind of backing your own.
John, have they really bent to the junior minister?
Oh, I think so. I mean, what's astonishing about this whole story is we had an extensive consultation period months ago, and there were over 3,000 submissions received on this. Everybody had their chance. Yet organisations, for example, like IBEC, for some reason, didn't submit.
Are you sure of that now?
I'm fairly sure. That they can correct me if not, but as I understand it, they didn't. But then they came out afterwards and said, well, actually, we need to go back to the drawing board. So clearly, there's been pressure on here from certain limited business groups. There's a group called the Dublin City Centre Traders Alliance, and they're basically, they want to run this whole process. And I think it's really dangerous for
Given how important it is to their livelihoods, so they're not entitled to ask people to rerun it and make sure they get it right.
Sure, but that's why we had an extensive consultative process where everybody, including the city centre traders, had their opportunity, Matt, to have their say. Now, what they're basically saying is, well, we lost that. We didn't like the way that came out. So now we're going to nip around the back. We're going to bend the ear of a friendly government minister and we're going to basically rerun this. Now, had it gone the other way, had this been rejected, and let's say that the pro-cycling lobby, if you like, went to the Greens and got them to overthrow this, I think there would be a hue and cry about it.
And that group that John was talking about, a lot of the retailers in that group also own car parks in the city centre. And it was only a couple of weeks ago that I think it was the owner of Brent Thomas and Arnott's said that the viability of their two Dublin institutions, is threatened by this plan. But the owners of Arnott's and Brent Thomas, they were saying it from a retail perspective, from their shops, didn't mention that they own the car parks tied to them. So really there's, you know, like obviously...
But where are people supposed to park their electric cars?
Leave them out of town, Matt. This is the key thing.
What's the point in switching to having an electric car if you aren't able to drive it into city centres and park it?
Well, I don't think we want electric cars in the city. That's why we want a public transport system. In fact, I'm sure everybody knows Waterford Whispers, the satirical website. They had a nice piece on this earlier today and they were quoting, well, a made-up quote from Eamonn Higgins. It went something like this. We need to hold off making improvements to public transport until public transport improves. And that's exactly the sack of nonsense that is involved in this process, where we're continually bending to vested interests, preventing improvements in the city. And I can assure you that the 1970s version of Eamonn Higgins would have been out demanding that we abandon this ridiculous attempt at pedestrianising Grafton Street. Sure, it'll be the end of civilization if we don't let cars, buses and God knows what drive up and down Grafton Street. It'll be the end times.
Okay, is this what I'm saying? I'm not sure that Brown, Thomas and Arnott's actually own the car parks.
They own car parks. They do own car parks in the city centre. The parent firm does, yeah.
All right, okay. Yesterday we had John in the last word on the environment spot talking about this national survey of how people feel about climate change issues. And one of the things that came up, Sarah, was that for all of young people's care for the environment, there's a liking for taking flights away to other places, not just maybe once a year, but multiple times a year. Are you guilty of that yourself now?
Well, I'm not trying to out my own finances, but I can't really afford to do that.
This is public shaming.
I can't really afford to be taking multiple flights a year.
Because it's actually a lot of older people in their 60s in particular are the ones who tend to be, as they're coming maybe to the end of their working lives, who are the ones who are heading off on a regular basis. But Sarah, there are a lot of people in your generation as well,
Matt,
who are actually going flights.
Don't I know it? I see all their photos. I'm like, why am I still here? But that's neither here nor there. Yeah, you see, the thing about surveys like this is it does kind of, I feel like climate change has nearly become an issue for, I suppose, those who can afford to like make the changes.
I'm not looking at John, as you said.
John, but I suppose it's a privileged position to be able to kind of fit climate change into your life. Like, for example, I don't drive and I'm vegetarian, and that's because I can afford the dietary supplements to not have to rely on meat. And it's because my area, like I grew up in North Dublin, so like my area is well facilitated, so I don't have to drive. But that
for public transport, you're a public transport user.
And okay. I'm a recently converted cyclist, John, so
there you go,
keep that in mind. But but that is coming from a place of privilege, and I don't think that there is wide enough recognition that, you know, to be able to make those changes and to be able to live sustainably is in many ways a privilege. You know, like there was a lot of kind of bashing of people who shopped in places like Penny's about 2019, because that was in vogue. It was in vogue to shop sustainably. But if you're a mother trying to like clothe her children, you don't really have another choice. So I think it's a very nuanced topic. But what really gets my goat is that people have said that, sure, in Ireland we're not being really affected by climate change, so I don't feel the duty of that. And I just think that is such a horrible double standard, because we, like, if anyone listened to Ben Finnegan's documentary from Malawi, it's the people who are least privileged who are suffering from it. And that's why I think it's kind of inexcusable. Now, Have I been on a plane this year? I actually haven't been on a plane this year, but again, that's probably just my own personal circumstances.
Do you plan to be on a plane later this year?
I would love a little holiday, if I'm being honest. But you know, like, that's like, I'm not one to talk. I'm not trying to throw stones. But I suppose when we step back and think about it from a bigger issue, you know, like, I think it is quite a privileged position to be coming from, to say like, oh, sure, like, I'm eco-friendly. I use eco, like, I compost my food and I do whatever. And then like, to kind of say, but like, this isn't in my eye line, so I'm still going to get on my, like, long-haul flight.
Yeah, I think it's important that we make the what we would call the right choices, that they shouldn't be the expensive choices and they shouldn't be the choices of privilege. So, as you said, having access to public transport actually reduces your costs. Not having to run a car saves people, on average, 10,000 euros a year after tax. There's loads of parts of the country, especially in rural Ireland, where people are forced to have not just one car, but two cars. And if you gave them genuinely high-quality public transport alternatives, they would take them. I've heard it said that the mark of a sophisticated country is not a country where poor people drive cars. It's where well-off people use public transport. That's what we want to get towards. And we've seen already that there simply isn't enough room anyway in our cities. Three Irish cities are in the top 100 most congested cities in the world, and we only a tiny little country.
What are the three of them? Dublin?
Galway?
Galway,
of course, and Cork.
Cork.
Yep.
Outer ring road for Galway, some people would say.
Oh,
John,
no,
I'm only winding you up before we take a break. John Gibbons and Sarah McGuinness with us for the week trending. Sarah, I don't know what the digital equivalent of newspaper will not refuse ink is, but tell us about this trolling article about Taylor Swift as a role model, which has got so much attention this week online.
Yeah, so it was published in Newsweek by a commentator called John McLean. Now, I actually don't know for sure, but that sounds like quite an Irish name. I can't verify that. Anyway, the headline on the piece is Taylor Swift is not a good role model. And he kind of starts it off by talking about this phenomenon, Swiftonomics, which, you know, everyone knows the economic impact. Like, I think overall spending in Dublin last week was 17%, up 17%, yeah. And it was boosted by her concerts being here. You know, like, she is an incredibly wealthy, well-known woman, has a massive fan base and is really, you know, like, not...
She's a brilliant performer and people then go to see her.
Oh, of course. Of course, yeah. No, she is. But anyway, so when he started off the piece, I was kind of like, okay, this is interesting, considering he started it from an economic angle. I was kind of thinking, oh, is he going to talk about how, like, you know, maybe her flight patterns and the fact that, you know, she has been kind of accused of using her young fans as a bit of a piggy bank. But that's neither here nor there. What the piece actually goes on to say is that essentially a woman who is not being controlled by a man and who has her own money and her own life and such a prominent place in society and who is in the public eye and therefore who's romantic life, for better or for worse, has been in the public eye, is not a role model, and young girls and women should be pushed towards more wholesome ideals, was the word
wholesome.
He used.
Wholesome.
Wholesome. In other words, being controlled by a man and not saying...
Jeez, misogyny is alive and well in some quarters, isn't it?
Oh, no, completely. And this kind of, like, obviously didn't get a great response, but this journalist in particular, I'm not trying to, like, call him out or, like, incite hatred or anything, but, you know, like, I had to look at some of his other works and they have been published widely in Irish publications. The Irish Independent ran something by him last week. Gripped, he's written a couple of pieces for Gripped, and like the one in the Independent this week, which is just also so ignorant, was, oh, don't want to try Ozempic, try eating healthy and exercising to lose weight. Like,
I did that myself, it didn't work, and that's why I'm a fan of the Ozempic. John Gibbons, of course, is this just another grumpy old man, perhaps just seeing an angle to get a bit of attention, earn a few quid by writing something?
Oh, definitely. I mean, it's lazy journalism. It really is. He finishes off by telling us what young girls truly need, perhaps without fully recognising it, because obviously they're idiots, are role models who provide both authenticity and actual depth rather than artificial narratives and superficial glamour. I don't know where this stuff gets off, but I guess here we are, Matt, talking about it. So maybe mission accomplished as far as this author, for want of a better word, has put it. But if you're reading this from a magazine from the 1950s, you'd say, oh my God, weren't we awful back in the day? But these days, this is, I think you introduced it as trolling. That's what it is. It's basically trolling and completely disempowering for a person. And again...
I do know something else. Somebody's just texted in and I was aware of this, and it's a great point. Taylor Swift has donated enough money to cover the food bills for an entire year across 11 food banks and 8 community pantries in Liverpool. She did that for every city she toured in the UK. To eradicate food poverty. I don't know what she did in Dublin last week, whether she has done, but I know she has given away an enormous amount of money in the UK out of her takings from the gigs.
Yeah, they're the kind of things we
should
look at.
She's a role model. And,
but also, as a role model, I would be critical of her, for example, with her sort of multiple private jet lifestyle. I really think as a role model in the climate crisis era, it's really irresponsible. But I appreciate that her particular line of work involves a hell of a lot of travel and it's not easy. She can't just hop on Ryanair. I do understand that.
And I think she's also been dragged over the coals for that repeatedly. Like, and I think that she's kind of dealt with that. But like, in terms of seeing someone who has gone from, you know, 16 years of age, like who has never claimed to be this self-made woman, like she's never claimed to be this, but who went through an eating disorder, has been publicly shamed, like has, like her whole life has been documented, and to now say as a 34-year-old woman, like this is who I am, and for so many people to be like, to buy into that, like I think it's just, yeah, as you said, just trolling for the sake of it.
Okay, well, let's talk about another global superstar, one who's male and who's 39 years of age, Cristiano Ronaldo. You're rolling the eyes at me there, Sarah. Why?
Oh, boo-hoo.
Well, hang on a second. Hold on a second. I thought we were supposed to be empathetic when people are upset. The man missed a penalty the other night at a crucial stage in Portugal's game, and he got very, very upset because of the brilliant save that came in against him.
No, I'm a crybaby. I cry all the time. I'm not saying Ronaldo's a crybaby. I'm a very emotional person. Like, I don't care if he cries or not. What I care about is everyone talking about it. I'm like, I am, like, let the man have a cry. Like, I am not the biggest Ronaldo fan. There are a couple of skeletons in his closet, which, you know, true, I still judge him by, and I will judge him by them far quicker than I will judge him for crying on the pitch. But who was it? Who was the RT commentator who said it's embarrassing?
Well, actually, let's hear a little Didi Haman, the pundit. This is how he reacted.
I'm just wondering how much of that display at halftime was performance as opposed to genuine emotion.
I don't care, Peter, I don't care. Mm. He's got a responsibility towards the team. He's the captain of the team. He's got a responsibility. And if he doesn't feel that he can't help the team anymore, then he's got to say to the manager, he's got to take me off. And this is the most embarrassing and most ridiculous decision I've seen ever. And Lisa says she's not seen it of Ronaldo. I've not seen it of anyone.
Yeah,
I've not seen it of anyone. Because he's a role model. There's a lot of kids who want to be like him. And failing is part of the game.
Yeah. Well, and we saw Luka Modric miss a penalty for Croatia. He accepted it, and moments later, he popped up to score a goal.
Yeah. And
vastly different reaction.
Well, this is how it should be, and yes, he does need to apologise. If he takes responsibility, you miss. It's part of the game. Nobody will ever go at him for missing it. And I don't know what he wanted to tell us with his reaction. I just found it utterly embarrassing what he did, because it's a team game, and you're still in the game. It's still 0-0.
So that's Didier Mann, been interviewed by Peter Collins. And is that a common sense reaction from the German football pundit?
I thought it was harsh, and I'm going to be the contrarian here. Just this one time.
Oh, really? Just this one time.
Because I honestly feel, right, first of all, Cristiano Ronaldo is an extraordinary athlete. Incredible athlete. Yeah, well, he's in the twilight of an incredible career. He's 39 years of age, which, in footballing terms, is the equivalent of being an 81-year-old president, right? I mean, he is an elderly man in footballing terms, right? And he was obviously feeling the limit of his powers, right? This is sort of like the lion in winter, right? And I really felt for him. I actually did. I felt that, okay, maybe it looked a little hammy, but also, maybe the reaction to this was that men are not supposed to cry. They're not supposed to express emotions in public. And when he did, the vulnerability, if you like, attached to that always draws that.
What about a bit of resilience that you're still out there doing a job? Cry afterwards if things don't go well. But in that moment, keep going.
Sure, I would totally agree with that. But I think he became overwhelmed at the moment. I think he thought he had blown it for his country.
He blown it for himself and his own records. And he hasn't scored a goal yet at the European Championships. Should he be dropped for tonight's game against France? Should Roberto Martinez decide not to be the Jill Biden of this and drop Ronaldo for the game?
Well, I suppose he's such an icon. He's like the Cú Chulainn of that Portuguese team. As long as the raven doesn't actually land on his shoulder, Matt, they will keep him on the pitch, right?
Sarah. Follow that.
The first time I've ever used...
That's sort of an Eric Cantona-style analogy. Sorry, go on.
What does a raven flying on the shoulder even mean?
Do you remember when Cú Chulainn was holding the bridge and he was dying, right? And he tied himself to the bridge and the other guys were so afraid of him that they wouldn't cross the bridge until the raven landed on his shoulder.
Is that a bit like Eric Cantona and the seagulls following the trawler?
Oh, my God. Like,
and the wisdom about the tomato, I think that was a Brian O'Driscoll one.
Knowing that a tomato is a fruit, but not to put it in the fruit salad.
But like, I'm kind of like, why are we all being so dramatic about this? Yeah, he had a little cry. Yeah, that's a little bit embarrassing. He messed up. Like, everyone messes up. I'm kind of like, now maybe it's just because I'm not a football fan. Maybe I don't know the significance of this. But I cry like a couple of times a week. Like, I'm kind of like, it's no big deal.
And you haven't missed a penalty.
And I never miss.
Sarah McGuinness from the Business Post. John Gibbons, thank you.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper. Weekdays from 4:30. Today.